Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone.
It's a post-primary day DMZ. I think the primary season is sort of at its peak right now.
We're just getting into it. Last night, Tom Tillis, the so-called establishment candidate, easily won the Republican primary. He had to get over 40%. I think he got like 56% in order to avoid a runoff. He will now face Kay Hagan in November in what appears to be a competitive race now.
You know, I've seen two competing narratives about that race and the notion of an establishment versus Tea Party narrative in general. One is that, and you know, by the way, there's a good Stu Rothenberg column of a roll call this week. It sort of lays out here, you know, there are a lot of races that really aren't, you know, quote unquote, Civil War primaries. But here are the handful that you could plausibly say people have chosen sides if you want to keep score. And so there's this one sense that, yes, there are a bunch of races out there where the Chamber of Commerce types are squaring off against Freedom Works and Senate Conservatives Fund and the other, you know, Tea Party type groups. And let's see who wins this battle of the primaries. And there's another narrative that I've seen pushed by Ed Kilgore over at the Washington Monthly, which is this is no civil war. There's no grand ideological dispute here. Tillis in particular said some very far right comments about the poor a couple of years ago that fit quite snugly with the Tea Party philosophy. So yeah, there may be some tactical and stylistic differences here, but it's not really an ideological division that we're viewing. Do you have a sense of which narrative is closer to the truth, or is there elements of the truth to both narratives?
I think elements of truth to both, but I think I would come down a little bit more on the latter. I think that this is maybe an indication that the Tea Party has already won, ironically. I mean, the easy story would be to write The Empire Strikes Back, that Tillis's victory is the triumph of the establishment. But I think this is more of an example of a pendulum swing, of a party and a movement searching out its identity. I think that it's maybe now reached a sort of leveling out where, you know, look, we had the low-hanging fruit, right? Early on, you had some really quality Tea Party conservative candidates like Marco Rubio and Pat Toomey running against some really kind of old and fat and happy and establishment corrupted people like Arlen Specter and Charlie Crist. We're now on like the third generation of this attempt, and I think, you know, it's less a sort of a Manichaean struggle now. Tom Tillis, the establishment candidate, is probably pretty darn conservative. Certainly not a villain. Is, you know, as easy to, you know, sort of villainize as say like a Charlie Crist or something. And his opponents weren't Marco Rubio. And so I think that what happens when you have movements like the Tea Party is, you know, their ideas get co-opted, and then other incumbents either get smart, get religion, or get ousted. And so it's hard to surprise people multiple times. And so I think that, you know, the Tea Party, you know, good and bad things came out of it. But at the end of the day, I think that they, you know, they may now be a victim of their success. But, you know, I feel like, you know, they sort of got their message across and did accomplish some things. There are going to be some interesting races to watch. You know, I expect Mitch McConnell to vanquish Matt Bevin in Kentucky. Really interesting one. A couple races coming up. One in Oklahoma, where you have Congressman Lankford versus, I think he's a Speaker of the House, T.W. Shannon. Shannon is half Native American, half African American. Lankford has the evangelical community on his side. That'll be an interesting race. In Nebraska, You've got this three-way race. Ben Sasse, who the conservative movement has coalesced behind. You've got Shane Osborne, who I guess now has become more of an establishment candidate. And then you've got a guy named Sid Dinsdale, who is a self-funder who is starting to show up in the polls, who could sneak up and sort of surprise everybody. So I think these are really interesting races to watch, but I don't know that the Republican Civil War narrative is all that true anymore.
I mean, I guess the question for me is, I mean, I agree. I don't think this series of primaries is going to ideologically recalibrate the Republican Party in any way. They think they're still very firmly conservative at this point, and there's not a lot of real serious move to the middle in this primary process. But there is a question: has the party base learned to choose the more electable candidate, the person who's not going to make the rape comment 1 week before election day, who knows how to who has a filter before they speak? The question I guess in North Carolina with Tillis is, I assume, I haven't followed too closely, but you can say, per Ed Kilgore's point, yes, I'm sure he said some very awful things in the past that you can pluck out the videotape and try to make some hay of it. But that's not quite the same as being so inept that you keep doing it, particularly, you know, in the final stretch of a race. I assume by the establishment supporter on Tillis that they think he's not that kind of guy, that he will hold it together. But I guess you don't always know. I don't think people knew, you know, I think people had a sense of Todd Akin. I mean, Claire McCaskill essentially helped the Republican primary electorate choose Akin by beating up the other candidates in the primary process because they figured Akin was not fit for prime time. But I don't get the sense that people have that sense of Richard Murdoch in advance. Mm-hmm. That people didn't assume Murdoch.
No, I talked to an establishment Republican who told me that, you know, Richard Murdoch was, I don't know, like at the Capitol Hill Club or the National Republican Senatorial Committee or someplace, and met all the muckety mucks, and they loved him, and there was no sense that he was going to implode.
That was the Indiana Senate race in 2012, which
so you can retroactively sort of throw him under the bus and blame the Tea Party and say he wasn't vetted, but I think that there was no indication that was going to happen. In the case of Todd Akin, you're right. I mean, the Democrats picked him. They tried to do that in North Carolina. Molly Ball over at The Atlantic has an interesting piece about how Hagan was trying to basically defeat Tillis in the primary, and that this is a pattern. Harry Reid did this, tried to get Sharon Angle and got her. And so this is something Democrats have been quite adept at doing. It did not work in North Carolina. In the case of Todd Akin, there is some revisionist history, though, that I keep trying to point out. Despite the fact that the Democrats sort of wanted him and saw that he was susceptible to these sort of things, he wasn't the Tea Party candidate. I mean, not Sarah Silverman, who was the candidate that I'm thinking? Steelman.
And that's who Palin was behind.
Right. Steelman was really much more of the Tea Party candidate. Akin was sort of more like the Mike Huckabee evangelical candidate. He had been a member of Congress. And so it's not like he was, you know, sort of a nobody. So in any event, he may have been a poor choice, but you can't, it's unfair to pin the Tea Party, to pin him on the Tea Party.
Now, the other race that I think is particularly relevant, I mean, some of this discussion speaks to our conservatives being more savvy in the conservative candidates that they pick, and early evidence suggests that they are, where they're not doing the Christine O'Donnell thing lately. But you have the case of Congresswoman Renee Elmers in North Carolina. I believe she will face off against Clay Akin now, although I guess that race is not quite called, but Akin had the lead last time I checked. But while all this media focus is on Clay Aiken, Elmer's was the only Republican incumbent in a primary race who has been very upfront, aggressive, in your face, in favor of immigration reform, a pro-immigrant immigration reform stance. You know, she went on Laura Ingraham and had it out with her on national radio, saying that it's perfectly conservative to be for immigration reform. And there was a Tea Party candidate that she faced off against. He made immigration front and center, and she won that race pretty handily. I've seen some folks nitpick and saying, oh, she only had 56% and she had 80% before, and the Tea Party challenger had barely any money. What do you expect? And well, but the point is that it didn't attract any money. It didn't attract a mass uprising against her. Sure, it obviously, when you take a firm stance, you're going to lose some support from, you know, near unanimous. But the point is, she took the stance and she handled it quite adroitly. So one, she did that. That's a signal to others that even in fairly conservative areas, you can take that stance and survive. And number two, apparently this is the only situation like that, that there haven't been other, I mean, there are other Republicans out there who have made some noise about immigration reform. They haven't attracted any Tea Party ousters. This is probably the only race, this is in all the House races where this is happening. So that's number two. And my final point is, I think this is a potential vindication of Boehner's constant zigzagging, the Boehner two-step, where he indicates he's for immigration reform, and then he backs away and pins the blame on Obama. You know, he gets mocked for being hypocritical and weak in doing this, but I think there's a logic to it, which is, I'm trying to keep the issue alive without fostering a massive Tea Party pitchfork brigade that tears the party in two. If I can keep this at a low simmer during the primary season, we'll be in good shape to actually tackle it when the primary season is over, after June. So that's my thoughts about that. I don't know what you think.
Well, look, I think it is interesting because the anti-immigration reform folks are so loud and so passionate about their issue that one, you know, they do sort of punch above their weight. And I think one does get the sense that they have more clout than they actually do have. Now, I think it would also be probably, you know, wrong to sort of attribute Renee Elmer's victory to you know, to the fact that this issue doesn't have legs, because I think I do think it does. It can move the grassroots. It's just, you know, how good was her opponent? It's so hard to beat an incumbent. You got to, you know, the stars have to align, kind of thing. So you know, the whole like big deal, no deal, little deal. I mean, I think this is like a little deal. So I wouldn't want to, like, you know, say that this means that you can, like, be, you know, sort of be pro-immigration reform and not fear any sort of repercussions in a Republican primary. On the other hand, I think that it probably is indicative of the fact that I think that you know, the Laura Ingrahams of the world, who can be very loud and very aggressive, you know, don't have the troops behind them that they may claim.
Speaking of loud and aggressive conservatives, Benghazi reappeared this week, and there was this memo that got released that came from, I believe, Ben Rhodes, who was on the National Security Council staff. I forget what his exact title is, I guess suggested that he had some role in the creation of the talking points the day that Susan Rice went out on TV. I don't want to get too much into the back and forth about is this the smoking gun or not. There's plenty of other places you can have that discussion. But what I think is I think the question on the left, if I may, is why do conservatives keep going back to this well? What is the point? Is it that, I mean, there's some mockery this week. You know, Fox News was covering the Obama Angela Merkel joint press conference, and they cut away and said, "We'll only come back to this if there's a Benghazi question." When Obama administration put out its new climate report yesterday, Dana Perino said, "Well, one of these meteorologists interviewing the president. Why don't they ask about Benghazi?" It seems to rise to this level of obsession. And so the question is, why? Is it that they think this is good politics, that this is actually going to be a good way to trip up Obama or trip up Hillary down the road? Is it that there is a sincere belief that this is the Watergate, that if they just pull this thread, the whole house of cards is going to come down? Or is there a third, at least for some, you know, for example, a Lindsey Graham or a John McCain, or John Boehner, who seem to pound their fist on this a lot, use that as a distraction to obscure the fact that they're actually being more conciliatory with the president on things like immigration. I imagine, like many things, maybe it's a combination of it all. But as someone who is inside the conservative movement, you know, when you talk to folks about Benghazi, what is the level of sincerity / level of cynicism that you think is brought into this push?
I think mostly it's sincere. I mean, I think that, first of all, I think that, you know, when you have, you know, an ambassador killed for the first time since like 1979, it's a big deal. I think there's a sincere desire to sort of get to the bottom of why our intelligence didn't see this coming, why the consulate wasn't reinforced, why there wasn't an effort to rescue, you know, the four people who were killed. And then I do think that there are still some serious lingering questions about whether or not the Obama administration intentionally tried to, you know, obfuscate what happened, and downplay, you know, the reality of it being a pre-planned terrorist attack, and for political reasons. So, you know, do some people think that this is smart politics or they can score points? Yes, I'm sure. But I really do believe that for most people, this is a very serious issue that they are sincerely want to get to the bottom of. And in fact, I would argue that may actually blind them to the political realities, which is that this may turn out to be bad politics for Republicans. And they may still push forward because they believe it's the right thing to do.
What I was going to ask you, is there a bad politics faction in Washington? Are there folks saying, look, you know, maybe there is something here, but we've gone down this path a lot. We, you know, it embarrassed Romney in the debate. We got embarrassed when we flogged that CBS report a couple months ago and it turned out to be phony. You know, we just keep looking bad every time we have an itchy trigger finger about the stuff. You know, maybe this is a little something. Maybe we should take a look at it. Maybe we should, you know, investigate and talk to some people and see if there's more there instead of getting all overly excited right away. Because a lot of times these leads don't pan out, and then we look like we're not focusing on the issues that other Americans care about.
Yes. I mean, I think that's why John Boehner didn't pursue this select committee until this most recent, you know, FOIA request produced this email. So I think that there has been a concern with that. I mean, if you go back to 1998, a year in which the president was indicted, Republicans still lost seats. I'm sorry, president wasn't indicted. He was impeached. Excuse me. Hear about that in the comments. President Clinton was impeached, I think, in December of 1998, and a month earlier than that, Republicans lost a lot of seats, even though they had really proven that they were right on the facts. They were still punished.
I don't, I, I,
they were still punished by the electorate.
I thought they didn't lose that much, just that they didn't have big gains that they expected. It was kind of like a, like maybe Democrats had a few small, but it was the 6-year itch.
But it was bad enough. It was bad enough that Clint that was part of the reason I think that Gingrich was ousted. Because of that. And in a midterm, you're supposed to, you know, you're supposed to pick up seats. And if you're the party out of power.
Right. And like this, people should remember, you know, I've saw a couple things this week. That's a bad parallel, but here's the better parallel is that there's a New Yorker piece that reminded us about Reagan's Benghazi, which was Beirut, where there was issues about not having proper security at the Marine barracks there, and a much larger terrorist attack occurred that killed, you know, hundreds of Marines. And Democrats were not able to turn that into their political favor, even though obviously it was a very serious issue. You know, Mondale was bringing it up in the debates in October of 84 and got nowhere with it. And even Iran-Contra, which, you know, a very serious scandal. Obviously, Reagan wasn't on the ballot after that, but Democrats were not able to turn that into a referendum on George H.W. Bush. So I think we've talked about this in past shows, but, you know, scandal politics seem to have pretty limited, yeah, you know, political juice. I mean, obviously there's the occasional Watergate. Maybe you actually get the guy, yeah, but more often it doesn't amount.
Bill, even as you pointed out, Watergate didn't work out that well for Democrats.
No, not in 72.
Not just that. I mean, you know, yes, and immediately it hurt Republicans, but, you know, Republicans still went on to dominate, you know, the generation after that. I mean, that maybe I'm confused, you know, correlation and causation. I mean, it ushered in.
Yeah, it didn't spark an ideological shift for a generation. 1974 was a good year for Democrats. You know, there were the Watergate babies that got elected, so they did have a short term.
And Jimmy Carter, I'll never lie to you. I mean,
right. And Gerald Ford got screwed on pardoning Nixon. So I mean, I think they had Democrats had a good little window in there, you know, because of
Watergate. But maybe they thought, like, we're going to go with the knockout punch. That this is the way. Right. This is the new model, and it didn't work. It certainly didn't work on Reagan. And not even in Iran-Contra.
So it seems to argue for, you know, I mean, I think everyone would agree. I think even folks on the left would agree that it is proper to investigate intelligence failure, security strategies, all that type of stuff. You know, what can we do better next time? Everyone would like to have that discussion. But you could have the discussion in a much sober way without always pushing for, let's see if there's a cover-up here, where that's where it seems like Republicans lead with their chin repeatedly and never really get the goods, perhaps because the goods aren't there. But it would seem more important going, even if you thought the goods were there, as a political risk to pursue, it seems it's a pretty low odds you're going to get it. Maybe you're better off just trying to solve the immediate problems of security and intelligence in a more low-key way.
Well, I think that's the question. I mean, how, you know, like, this is our third thing, right? So there was, like, the economy is going to take down Obama. Then it was Obamacare. We're going to just talk about Obamacare. And now there's this, right? And I think that, like, if this is handled prudently and responsibly, it could potentially help Republicans or maybe just be a side issue, right? But if this becomes the dominant issue, and here's where you could have the sort of ironic problem of Fox News. I mean, if they make this into the dominant issue, putting Trey Gowdy, whom I am not sold that he is the best face in terms of the communicator, the front man of this, although he did do well this morning on Morning Joe, so maybe I'll be proven wrong. But, you know, this could be the thing is, like, on one hand, if this is sort of handled as a serious inquiry that's sort of ongoing but not the dominant issue, then maybe it just, you know, maybe it doesn't matter that much. But I think there is a problem or a concern, like, if this becomes the dominant issue, if Trey Gowdy becomes the face of the Republican Party, and if the brand of the Republican Party becomes about this investigation, even if they uncover some legitimate facts and responsibility, I don't know that that's a win politically for them. I think it's dangerous. I mean, again, if this is a side dish and part of their electoral plan, that's one thing. But if this becomes the dominant issue and not Obamacare, not the economy. I mean, see, I think Republicans do well when it's about the Democrats, right? Because nobody likes the Democrats. Nobody likes politicians. But the only thing the American public hates worse than the Democrats are the Republicans. So if there's a boomerang effect and this becomes about Trey Gowdy, about the Republicans' witch hunt, I think that's not necessarily a good move for Republicans electorally. Again, you could argue it's the right thing to do morally, but electorally is what we're talking about here.
Now, I know that you think it is morally correct to pursue the Benghazi allegations, and you think it is immoral to embrace identity politics, but you have recently argued that identity politics might actually be more politically sensible, and you're also arguing now that perhaps pursuit of Benghazi is not politically sensible. If I may segue into your column for the week about the newfound love of identity politics amongst Republican candidates.
Well, and this shows the the dichotomy sometimes between what's right and what works. I mean, they're not necessarily the same thing.
So what you know, for folks who haven't gone to an uppity college,
you mean the people who went to Shepherd College in West Virginia, the Rio Linda of liberal colleges.
Those of us who went to Oberlin College know full well about identity politics,
that's where Lena Dunham went, right?
among many other illustrious alumni,
and Michelle Walken as well.
That's correct. So, you know, the notion that you pursue politics based on people's identities, whether it's race or religion or sexual orientation or ancestral heritage, that you pursue politics by patching together these different coalitions and communities, which Democrats have been more open about in recent years, Republicans have kind of wagged their finger at, but you are starting to see, according to your analysis, you know, more Republicans, talking about vote for me because I'm a woman type of argumentation, and that arguably we haven't seen that as much in the past. I think we discussed this on a past show. I had said, look, Republicans, do Christian identity politics, and they do Catholic identity politics. They might do Southern identity politics, but there's all sorts of ways you can slice and dice identity that Republicans have long been comfortable with. And look, people have been going after the Irish vote and the Italian vote and the German vote, forever. So it's not really new. It's just when you do it with blacks or Latinos or gays, it seems more controversial for some reason. But I guess there are certain more Democrat Party identified identity groups that Republicans are trying to get in on. Like women, like minorities, and they're starting to talk about more openly now. You think that it might work, even though it makes you uncomfortable?
Well, yeah. Look, it makes me uncomfortable because, I mean, I think it's sort of a fundamental belief of conservatives, at least modern conservatives, that we should be sort of colorblind and genderblind, and that the best person ought to win. And when you're saying, well, but I'm going to, strategically, I think a woman will be better because they won't be able to attack her as part of the war on women narrative, then what you're doing is, in a sense, discriminating against somebody based on their gender. You're discriminating against the white guy, basically. It's reverse, it's like reverse discrimination or something, right? Whether it's, So in other words, if you truly believe in being colorblind or genderblind, then that means that you don't have. I mean, this is like why conservatives are essentially against affirmative action. But what we're seeing is conservatives practicing affirmative action, you know, in a sort of de facto manner, where, you know, they're, you know, and this has been happening now for a long time, I think, but you're starting to actually see them publicly say, I'm supporting Karen Handel because she, it'll be harder for them to play the war on women thing against her. Or this candidate in Oregon, Dr., I think it's Webby, because she's a woman. Or in Jonathan Martin's New York Times profile of T.W. Shannon, I mentioned him earlier, who's half Native American and half Black, where Sarah Palin says, you know, even just the name, you know, like, in other words, Sarah Palin is saying, like, what a great, we should nominate him because, you know, what are they going to do? What are they going to, they can't say we're racist if we nominate him. And Ted Cruz, in that same Jonathan Martin New York Times piece, sort of like, you know, hey, wait a second here, or, you know, let's not get involved in identity politics. So there is a debate and a struggle on the right as to whether or not to do this. They're doing it. And it very well may be smart, and it may be that you have to do it, that you have to fight fire with fire. But it is the fact that it's now being sort of acknowledged and talked about openly is ironic for a party that has really hated it when the left played identity politics and philosophically is against, you know, any sort of like race-based preferences for anybody. It's happening unofficially, and it's probably the smart move politically.
Well, I wonder if it would it perhaps over time actually get conservatives to rethink their opinions about affirmative action, because I mean the argument, I mean the Democratic argument, the liberal argument about affirmative action, you know, generally has been it's not just about number counting. It's about, you know, taking a breath and making sure, am I really casting a wide enough net that I don't inadvertently discriminate somebody unconsciously? So let me just make sure I got a full pool of candidates, and in the, you know, in the application process, or in this case in politics, in the primary process. And there's a second argument, you know, as far as my final team, whether it's a workforce or a court or a Congress or whatever, am I going to have a final result that actually gets a diversity of experience and perspective? And that goes beyond just things like race and gender. There's a lot of other criteria you want to make sure you have a balance of. But, you know, it's a big country, and there's a lot of different communities, a lot of different perspectives out there. And so if you had a Congress that was all men, and if they were all qualified, there's going to be perspective you would lose if there were no women right on it. And so you might want to say, maybe we should take a break and say, maybe I missed something over here.
Yeah.
And if I made a mistake before, I need to compensate for that. Republicans are saying we need to do that too.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of interesting things here. One, I think that there could be like a fake it till you make it phenomenon here where – by virtue of the Republicans having all of these high-profile minority candidates, they actually could start to change their views slowly, and like literally become not just sort of window dressing, but actually that the party's views would change by virtue of the fact that there are so many prominent people of diverse backgrounds. I do want to warn you, though, or caution you. I think that one of the problems is the unintended consequences that happen. And so, ironically, you have the situation where Democrats have really, in a way, hurt themselves. There are more, you know, if you look at Rubio and Cruz and Martinez and Sandoval and Scott and Haley and Jindal, I mean, there are more prominent minority Republicans at high-profile jobs, senators and governors, than Democrats. Part of the reason is Democrats have created these majority-minority districts. So they had a very well-intentioned idea, which was let's create districts that are majority-minority so we could have more members of the House, more Black members of the House. Sounds like a good idea, right? Here's the problem with it. So in order to create these districts, you've essentially ghettoized people. You know, the people who get elected there are very left-wing and are serving a constituency that doesn't match the larger statewide electorate, and therefore you have people who can never get, you have minority Democratic members of House who can never appeal to a larger electorate, who can't get elected statewide. It's a problem Republicans don't have, that Republicans have been able to do this because they didn't have this, you know, problem, which I think was maybe well-intentioned. So once you start, that's, I think, one of the things that conservatives would argue is that once you start sort of picking winners and losers and trying to rig the system to benefit one group over another, you could ironically hurt the very group that you're trying to help.
Well, I think in the case of the majority districts you're talking about, you know, probably got hurt the most for Republicans in that, you know, they might have got a better deal in certain states that they end up with more districts than the Democrats got, but they end up being they only had to win with white votes for a long time in a lot of these places, and so that has hurt them now when the country's changing demographically and they need to figure out how to reach out these other communities. Yeah, and this kind of gets into I think. You know, the motivation right now, the way you talked about this in the beginning was almost sort of defensive. You know, let's have a woman so they can't play the war on women card on us. And, you know, that only goes so far if the woman you have put up is appealing to other women and is speaking a language that other women can understand. You know, in the case of, say Marco Rubio versus Ted Cruz, I mean, I think Rubio is someone who knows how to speak in a way that is not off-putting to Latinos. He doesn't sound like he's trying to run Latinos down, or other minorities down for that matter. Whereas, you know, Ted Cruz has said some things, man, he's anti-Latino, but I think he said some stuff where it suggested that, you know, Latinos have a better work ethic than blacks do. And I'm not quoting verbatim here. I don't have the quote at the top of my head. But I think so that was kind of the implication of his comment. You know, that's not useful perspective, I think, for the Republican Party going forward. Obviously he won his race outright. I'm not saying he didn't deserve to win his race. But as far as what's going to help the Republican Party be more competitive in different communities, when you have people who can give you a perspective that you didn't have before, that's useful to the party writ large. I think Rubio's given him some of that. I don't know, and I don't have Sarah Palin. You made Sarah Palin the nominee. That would not necessarily lead to, you know, a huge outpouring of love from women voters, because she has a lot of positions and a lot of comments that don't necessarily resonate with what a lot of women think.
I think you make some valid points. I think that now Palin and Cruz, I mean, they're sort of special cases. I mean, Palin, I think, was viewed as a very serious threat to the left, and she was a very high-profile candidate, and a lot of effort was made to destroy her, and I suspect, and then, I think she sort of played into that, and now I do suspect she would do very poorly amongst women. But that's not really the generic woman. I mean, that's a special case. And I do suspect, in the case of, like, Michigan, where you have Terry Lynn Land, the Republican candidate, running against a male Democrat, that it is harder, regardless of her positions, that it is harder to attack her and to accuse her of being part of some war on women, just by virtue of her. Now, she does also seem to be likable. I mean, too. She does seem, you know, it's not just that she's a female, but I do think that you know, there is a calculation made that, you know, I think that Republicans are tired of being accused, and conservatives are very tired of being accused of being racist, sexist, and they nothing ticks them off more than that. And so if they can support Herman Cain or whomever, that's sort of evidence that they're not what their enemies say that they are. And so I think you do have the sort of risk of having a situation where there is sort of favoritism based on race and gender. it doesn't always work. I mean, it, statistically speaking, being a white guy is probably still a pretty good deal if you want to, like, be elected to something, right? But having said that, all things being equal, if I'm in a Republican primary and I'm a conservative, do I like my chances a little better if I'm ethnic, if I'm a woman? I think I probably do in this era. And this, now you could argue, well, it's about time. White men have had, you know, have sort of had it easy for a long time, and maybe turnabout's fair play. But I think it is. I mean, I do think that this is a phenomenon, and it's not definitive, but I think it's a selling point that can, in the market, is sort of in the marketplace, can set you apart. And so I think you're seeing it, and it's not just me saying it. It's people. It is prominent conservatives saying, I'm endorsing this person because they can't use the war on women against her, or people like Sarah Palin essentially implying that, you know, T.W. Shannon, certainly one of his attributes would be his racial diversity. Maybe that's not a bad thing, but it does sort of go against the conservative idea of being colorblind and genderblind and being completely merit-based.
Well, we've talked a lot today about ongoings inside the conservative movement. I want to bring up one issue involving the progressive movement or liberal movement. That happens to be something that I wrote for The Week magazine last week. You have a new book from Ralph Nader called Unstoppable, where he is proposing a left-right coalition, which essentially, I think more accurately, be leftist/libertarian, where he argues there are dozens of points of convergence on issues where if left and libertarian right came together, we could, to quote his subtitle, dismantle the corporate state. And some of them are more obvious, you know, whereas reining in the NSA or going after corporate welfare or government subsidies. He starts off the book with a couple of examples in the 80s where he was involved in coalitions that stopped a nuclear reactor because it had gone over budget. So he got the left on anti-nuclear, he got the right on cost. And another law that meant to crack down on government waste and fraud, where the left and the right came together on in the 80s. In the first interview in promotion of the book, he was asked, you know, can this happen bottom or does it need leaders? He said, well, it needs leaders. And so what about Rand Paul? And he goes, Rand Paul, well, he's a mixed bag, but he's evolving, he's broadening his issues. You know, his problem is he doesn't work well with people. You know, not that he has lots of horrible ideas that I don't agree with, or he has a problem, you know, using facts to make his arguments. And the same interview, he called Obama, he said Obama should be impeached. He said Hillary was an international militarist. So he's being far more, you know, congenial to Rand Paul than to Obama and Clinton. So I wrote a piece saying, Rand Paul wants liberals to get behind Rand Paul. Don't do it. Ralph Nader wants people to get behind Rand Paul. Don't do it. And not just about him as a person, but the whole concept of the left libertarian coalition, you know, has a fatal flaw in that, sure, if anything that involves any kind of restraining of government and spending less money, you can find those points of convergence. Once you get into issues where liberals want government to spend more money or to have more regulation, you're not going to get any libertarians around that. That's totally anathema to their being. You know, so Nader has a list of 25 issues that he thinks that would have juice, and he ends with, you know, with healthcare and environmentalism. And it's like, where's the convergence there? There's nothing. Or whatever you could find would be so small that it wouldn't get to where liberals want to go. So it's one thing, as I ended the piece, it's one thing to say there should be ad hoc coalitions. Look, if I mean, I, as you know, I'm not an anti-NSA liberal. But if you are, I understand if you want to partner with libertarians around that issue, you know, go to it. That's your choice. But Nader's talking about a permanent coalition to dismantle the corporate state. And if you do that, as I've long argued, there's lots of points of convergence with corporations that liberals have used much more successfully over the past 100 years, whether it was the New Deal or environmental regulation. Obamacare is the most recent example where liberals have gotten a lot out of finding common ground with corporations, I think far more substantively than what you get out of working with libertarians. So I would argue, look, keep it at an ad hoc level where you go where the coalition makes sense. But if your objective is dismantle the corporate state, well, you're really missing out on a ton of opportunities where, you know, it's infrastructure spending, the Chamber of Commerce is for that. Obama's working with the utility industry right now on the EPA carbon cap regs. You don't want to cut off those opportunities because, frankly, I think those actually have more potential than the libertarian ones. So I don't know your thoughts on that, Matt. Do you think Nader's onto something and the right should hear him out? Or if you think this is just bad news for everybody and everyone should just stay away from each other?
I mean, it sort of strikes me as coming from out of left field. I mean, I think you've got two, if a reordering takes place, you sort of have two obvious places for the Democrats to go. One would be Hillary Clinton land, where she tries to return to the sort of Clinton era, and she sort of is a little bit hawkish, and completes the Obama effort to exercise the demons of the sort of dovish Democratic Party that cost, you know, that sort of existed during their time, you know, mostly out of power, out of presidential power. And the other direction, which is closer to this, I think, is the Elizabeth Warren direction, where I feel like the sort of millennial Marxist thing, the Jacobin Piketty thing, is more connected to the sort of Elizabeth Warren, the direction she might go, than libertarian. It feels like the sort of civil libertarian wing on the left has I feel like taken a back seat. I mean, you know, there is this kind of anti-corporatist strain that's represented by Elizabeth Warren, but I think that's more of like a class warfare haves versus the have-nots thing than a distrust of governmental power thing. Maybe I'm wrong, but this strikes me as being out of touch with the zeitgeist.
Well, I think, and I think Warren has a lot more juice on the left right now than Nader does. Nader still is having a hard time getting over. Over 2000, so I think there are some folks out there saying, you know, I don't want to hear what Nader has to say about anything anymore. But I do think that he has more fans on a strain of the left that, you know, are cynical about Obama, who don't like the deals he's made with corporations, who feel he hasn't been hard enough on the banks, and so those folks are hesitant about Hillary. They think she's too close to Wall Street. And so, you know, what concerns me as a Democrat is if the Nader view does gain traction and it siphons off a degree of Democratic support because people aren't thinking through and recognizing that, yes, we hate corporations for this and that, and we want to do more about the wealth inequalities and all that stuff, but that shouldn't cut off opportunities for common ground negotiation because they have been very fruitful for us in the past. Even if it may be impolitic to say, maybe me look like a jerk for bringing it up, but that's just the history. And there's lots of other things that we do care about, particularly climate and infrastructure, where there is hard evidence of of convergence with corporations that we that I think we need to pursue. So that's why I don't think it's totally out of left field. I do think there is that strain of the left out there that wants to wash their hands of anything involving corporate America. And are fascinated by Rand Paul, not just on the NSA stuff, but also on foreign policy. And so I mean, Nader in 2000 had a negligible amount of support. It was just enough in a close race to cause problems. But I do agree with you that I think, you know, Warren and Piketty have, or Piketty, I think is the proper pronunciation. I think they are capturing a broader chunk of the left. They're capturing more of their imagination than Nader is. Absolutely. Is Nader capturing enough to give Democrats some problems in 2016?
Indeed.
Well, perhaps we should leave it on that note, sir.
And it's a good place to leave it. Always a good time talking with you, Bill Scherer.
You too, Matt Lewis. Until next week, we'll catch you back in the DMZ.
You got it. See ya, DMZ World.